And as we continue to follow the latest developments from Paris, the question has come up once again, how Islamic is ISIS? And when ISIS leaders talk about reestablishing the caliphate, what do they mean? Joining us now for a little Islam 101 are Asma Afsaruddin, a professor of Near Eastern Languages and Cultures at Indiana University, and Jonathan Brown, the director of the Prince Al-Walid bin Talal Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding at Georgetown University. Welcome to both of you. And Jonathan, when does the history of Islam begin?
Well, the history of Islam begins with the beginning of the prophethood of Muhammad in year 610 of the Common Era. Politically, it begins in the year 622 when the prophet moves from Mecca to Medina and establishes the first political community of Muslims there. And in terms of the caliphate, it starts when the prophet dies 10 years later in 632, and there is a question of who will succeed him. And the word caliph actually means successor to the prophet of God. Basically, from the year 632 when he dies until 1924 when the caliphate is abolished by the founder of the Turkish Republic, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, you have the caliphate in existence.
And Asma, how are the beliefs being spread around that region at that time?
Okay, this is actually an important point. Even though the military conquest of a number of these areas that came under Muslim control, I refer to Iran and then Egypt, Syria, and what is today Iraq, pretty quickly, Islam itself as a religion did not spread at the same time. So we have Muslim rule spreading, but not the religion of Islam. The inhabitants of these areas that came under Muslim rule remained largely Christian. That was the case until about three centuries after the conquest. So,
and how is that possible? How would you have Muslim rule but Christians living in those places?
Because, I mean, the Quran very clearly says there is no coercion in religion. And for most of the time, Muslims observed this commandment. You know, there was just a general acceptance that you cannot spread religion, and in this case specifically Islam, by compelling people to adopt it. Eventually, it did spread. But again, mostly through education, and the local inhabitants learned about Islam firsthand.
And were there in later centuries, Jonathan, attempts to convert people en masse?
Not really. I mean, you had every once in a while some, you know, crazy local governor or some ruler would take the leader of some revolutionary group and say, you know, you better become Muslim or else. But that was really for political reasons. You just don't have forced conversion in Islamic history. Even into the early modern period, it's something that is very, very rare.
I want to talk about a few different terms that we hear when we're talking about Islam and the Muslim world, one of which is Salafism. What is that, Asma?
So Salafism actually refers to the idea that what the Prophet and his companions in particular did are worthy of emulation by succeeding generations of Muslims. Now, we have to remember that the earliest Salafis were represented in the modern period by Muhammad Abdu and Rashid Rida. These were people who believed that you needed to go back to the original sources, of course, of Islam, particularly the Quran and the Hadith and the Sunnah, the normative practices of the Prophet Muhammad, and critically engage the intellectual and religious heritage of Muslims. And that was actually prompted by a desire to adapt to modernity. Muhammad Abdu lived in Egypt. He was under British colonial occupation. There were a lot of, shall we say, Orientalist critiques of Islam, particularly as a religion that was ossified and incapable of adapting to modernity. So actually, the earliest strain of Salafism is born out of a genuine desire to find resources within the Islamic intellectual and historical tradition for adapting to modernity.
But it doesn't connote modernity now in the current form, right?
I think one of the things that is people get confused about, when people talk about Salafism today, what they're really effectively talking about is it's like Muslim Protestantism. So for about 12 centuries of Islamic history, you have this buildup of different schools of law and theology and sort of a clerical class. And what the Salafi movement says, and it sort of emerges in the 1700s and really crystallizes in the early 20th century, is that you need to go back to the scripture. You need to cut through all this tradition, cut through all this accretion, all this theology, and this sort of clerical layer between the believer and the original scriptures of Islam. And so it's actually, you know, very analogous to the difference between Catholicism and Protestantism and Christianity.
And what about Wahhabism, Jonathan?
Well, they don't like to call themselves that. They just call themselves Sunnis, but people who don't like Wahhabis call them Wahhabis. This is basically one of these sort of Salafi movements of revival and reform that emerges in the 1700s, this emerges in Central Arabia in the mid-1700s under a religious scholar named Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab. And basically, it's sort of an attempt to revive and purify Muslim practice in that area. And it becomes this religious scholar, Ibn Abdul Wahhab, teams up with the Saudi family, and they create this religious state, which goes through eventually three kind of permutations for the current country of Saudi Arabia.
But it sounds like there is a thread in all of this, and this is certainly something that we've heard. There is a view among many Muslims that the Islam that is practiced is not as pure as it should be.
I mean, I think that's a really important point, which is that Salafism and, to a large extent, Wahhabism as sort of a subset of Salafism are premised on the idea that Muslims had gone astray from the original teachings of the Prophet Muhammad and people had to be brought back to the straight path. Now, of course, there's a lot of disagreement about how you bring them back. A lot of Salafi scholars, the vast majority, would say, you know, you educate people and you write books and you give them speeches and you try and encourage them. A small minority have chosen militarism to do that, and those are the ones that make the news.
Well, and Asma, let me go back to you on this. If you take all that we've just heard there, and especially what we were hearing about the spread of Islam in the early days, and you compare it to what ISIS wants to do now— do they want to be back in the 7th century, or what is the view, as you see it, of some of these fundamentalist Muslims?
Well, that's what they claim, right? But ISIS is very much a product of the modern period, though. I mean, even though they claim they want to go back to the 7th century, notice how adept they are at manipulating modern media, right? Social media. They have no compunction about using modern technology that in many ways you can regard as a product of secularism, right, of secular knowledge, to spread their ideology. I would see them as a political movement. Now, what I said about the early Salafis, a number of them were actually modernists, not purists in the sense that Jonathan described, that is often associated with the Wahhabis today. Salafism today has become a term of opprobrium because of these modern-day Salafist movements, you know, which are so intolerant. They practice takfir, which is a notorious doctrine that they wield almost as a tool to bludgeon other Muslims into silence, declaring them to be non-Muslims and therefore making their blood licit to be fought against and killed. This kind of ideology has, I think, owes a lot to current political conditions where religion is instrumentalized. So they, you know, cherry pick their way through the Islamic legal tradition, pick out terms that they can exploit to their advantage. It's not a coherent ideology as such. And I think this is where the danger of the doctrines espoused by groups like ISIS and others really lies.
Jonathan?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you talk about ISIS, this is a different phenomenon from Salafism. So even the most hardcore Salafi ideologues, who normally, you know, people are terrified of, they consider ISIS to be heretical. So even the Grand Mufti of Saudi Arabia, sort of the greatest representative of Wahhabism, if you will, he considers ISIS to be either heretical or to have exited the pale of Islam entirely. Because what ISIS is it's a manifestation of the first heresy to appear in Islam, which is called Kharijism, which is the belief that if somebody commits a sin that ISIS thinks is serious or says something that ISIS thinks is unacceptable, that they must not really believe in God. And if they don't really believe in God, then they're no longer Muslim and they can be killed.
Which doesn't comport at all to what you were talking about earlier about how you weren't compelled to believe something when
right.
Islam was spreading
in the
beginning.
So Islam is a religious tradition, and this is true in Sunni and Shiite Islam really across the board for 1,400 years. It's an extremely conservative tradition when it comes to excommunication or anathemization. So, you know, Sunnis and Shiites, they disagree with each other, but they all consider each other to be Muslims. What the difference is with the Kharijite heresy, which is manifested today with ISIS, is that it says not only can we declare that other people are no longer Muslims, but we get to decide what reasons can lead someone out of Islam. So, for example, ISIS says if you believe in any secular ideology like nationalism or socialism or anything like that, you're no longer Muslim and we can kill you.
And it's not Islamic is what you're saying.
Yeah, actually, this is what's really interesting is this really kind of, I'd hate to say, this moronic debate that the American public square has been engaged in for over a year now, is ISIS Islamic? Okay, no Muslim scholars approve what ISIS is doing. None. They condemn their ideology. They condemn their actions. So the idea that somehow all the Muslim scholars in the world who can't agree on anything, basically, they all agree that ISIS is completely un-Islamic. The fact that we're sitting there saying, oh, is ISIS Islamic or not? I mean, this is really to ignore the global Muslim community and to say that sort of we as, I don't know, American political analysts or something are actually going to we're going to agree with ISIS. When ISIS says we're the true Muslims, we're going to agree with them? That's kind of ridiculous if you think about it.
That's Jonathan Brown, who directs the Al-Waleed Bin Talal Center for Muslim Christian Understanding at Georgetown University. And we've also been speaking with Asma Afsaruddin, who is a professor of Near Eastern Languages and Cultures in the School of Global and International Studies at Indiana University. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.